Hi, I'm the self-development coach, Johnny Lawrence, and welcome to the Self-Development Podcast.
Where's the awareness that we can create around our sense of self to use that awareness in a really positive way for our future? When I say future, right now in the here and now, our present self and things that we want to do in the future. There is no such thing as time. It's just in the moment we are here right now as you're listening to this podcast episode. And the more we can live in that present moment and experience gratitude and appreciation and awareness of ourselves and others, the happier we can be, the more grounded we are, the support around our own well-being and our relationships and our career. And, you know, it just magnifies. We can piggyback off all of that energy to bring us into things that we want to do.
In this episode, I'll be chatting with the award-winning money coach, Catherine Morgan. Catherine is a qualified financial planner and certified financial coach, and she has set herself the mission to reduce financial anxiety and increase financial empowerment and resilience for 1 million women around the world. Catherine has been featured as one of the top 32 female entrepreneurs to look out for in business leadership. She's the host of the Top 1% Global podcast, In Her Financial Shoes, and the founder of The Money Panel. Recently, she won the Financial Wellbeing Champion of the Year and Marketing Influencer of the Year 2022. And Catherine is the author of the best-selling book, It's Not About Money, 3 Steps to Become a Wealthy Woman. Now, I don't think I can become a wealthy woman, but I'm pretty sure I can earn a heck of a lot. Catherine, how are you today?
But you empower so many women, right? So that's okay.
Oh, good. I get a little pass. I like that. I do like that. How are you today? You okay?
I'm great. Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to come and talk to your community and your listeners around this subject.
No, I'm really, really grateful because what you're doing is amazing. As a coach myself, I work with lots and lots of people, but I do work with a lot of women, and money's a thing. Money is a thing. I find personally, and I'm sure we'll get into it, that a lot of women undervalue themselves a great deal and don't charge their worth. And that is frustrating, but it's mainly not really about the money in some cases. And I'm sure we'll get onto that. But I'm sure anyone that's listening has heard of you, but if you could just tell people a bit about yourself and like share your early experiences with money and how it impacted your perception of money moving forward, that'd be great.
Yeah, of course. Actually, before I do that, I would love to just say something about what you shared there, because I hear a lot of this around, you know, I'm not charging my worth. I'm not charging enough. And I think this is where the problem lies, is that if you think about that statement, I'm not charging my worth, we're actually directly relating our sense of self to how much we earn.
Yeah.
And it gives a lot of our power away to money. When money is it's an energy, it's a thing, you know, it's an exchange of value, however you want to frame that. But therein lies the problem, is that we attach our sense of self through our language to money, and that's very disempowering. So actually we need to move away from this connection between sense of self and money, because if our sense of self isn't very high and we don't feel good about our worth and good about ourselves, then we're never going to charge enough in our businesses or asking for pay rises, you know. So and this very much brings me into the story that I grew up with around money, in that I became a financial advisor at the age of 19. And for a woman to be a financial advisor at a young age was quite unfamiliar in the banking sector when I was working as a finance professional. And because, you know, we've grown up in this belief that men are the hunter-gatherers, they're the main wage earners, they're the main financial contribution to the household. And it's not normal for a woman to be the wealthy provider or to earn more than their partners. And certainly for me growing up, my parents divorced when I was very little, which is a trauma in itself, you know, and without going into blame and shame stories there, because that's not what that's about. I grew up in a world where it wasn't acceptable for women to earn money. And actually there was a lot of financial manipulation and abuse involved in relationships that I was surrounded by. And my dad had a lot of money. He is a very successful entrepreneur. And my mum just kind of got by. She just had enough. And what was curious for me is that when I was growing up around money, even as a financial advisor, I knew everything there was to know about managing money, investing, tax advice. I was giving people advice on this stuff. Was I doing it myself? No. Like, I lived in this huge trauma cycle of repeated beliefs that I didn't think I was very good. I had a really lack, like body shame, low confidence in my body. I had eating disorders all through my teenage years. And subsequently, I treated money the way I treated myself. And the way we treat ourselves is a mirror reflection of how we treat money. And so I wouldn't look at money because I didn't want to look at myself. I used to hide my bank statements. I would overspend every month. And I lived in this constant debt shame cycle as a financial advisor. So you can imagine the guilt and the shame associated with that behavior. And this is the challenge for a lot of women, is that we all often focus on the practical side of money. How can I make more money? How can I work harder in my business? How can I create new products and launches? And we get into burnout because we're focusing on the practical side. Whereas actually everything goes back to the behaviors that we have are driven by the emotions that we experience around money, the guilt, the shame, the fear, the regret, the responsibility, the judgment. And those emotions are driven by our thoughts that are driven by our core beliefs. And our core beliefs go right back to before the age of seven. So for me, being in a finance space as a financial advisor, living in these debt shame cycles, I had two really powerful moments in my life that completely changed everything. The first was when I was in my late 20s fiance and I decided to move to Jersey in the Channel Islands with work. And I walked into this coffee shop on the way to work one morning and I picked up this leaflet and it was about personal styling. And I was like, oh, if only someone could come into my house and weed out my wardrobes and declutter everything and help me to dress for my body shape. And she came to my house, weeded out all of my wardrobes, did all of that. And she left me this one evening, it was in the middle of the winter, and she left me sitting on this little red couch in this little cottage in Jersey, surrounded by about 13 bin bags worth of clothes. And I just remember literally sobbing and sobbing and sobbing. And it was like someone had suddenly given me permission to get rid of all of the crap in my life that I'd been hoarding onto, because I was looking at what everybody else was wearing, what everybody else was doing, because I was fearful about what I would discover if I was to do that for myself. And I then trained to become an image consultant myself. I was like, oh my God, this is life-changing. I have to help other women with their relationship with their body. And I trained to be an image consultant. And that was my first business. And that was the start of the journey, really, of really understanding my relationship with self, my relationship with my body, and the relationship that I had with money.
Thank you for sharing that. That is a very powerful story. Just that aspect of it, like being surrounded by the bags. I really got that visual. It's a really powerful story. And it made me think when you were talking about your mother and mums and women in general, a lot of the clients that I speak to that are women working in business, they always bring up mum guilt. But oddly, I don't ever hear about dad guilt. It's interesting. I'm not saying there is or is anything there, but it's just amazing to me that there, as you say, there's this inbuilt guilt that's there, like, oh, you shouldn't be working, you know, you shouldn't be doing all these hours, you should be at home, you should do this, you should, and we all know that word should is somebody else's agenda. So I just think that what you're saying there is just super powerful, and I'm absolutely positive there'll be men and women that are resonating with that. But you mentioned there were two things that changed you.
Yeah. So that experience for me personally sort of shifted some beliefs and core beliefs in myself and how I felt about myself. And then, you know, it took a good period of time, a good 4 or 5 years, I would say, to really start to see the transformation that had occurred for me there. And then when I went into my 30s, I started to have family and I had two boys who are now almost 9 and 11. And it was when my second son was born where we almost lost him twice. So he almost lost him when he was born. He had an infection at birth that wasn't picked up. And we were told there was a 50-50 chance he was going to survive when he was 3 days old.
Oh.
And beyond that, he recovered. He was in hospital for a couple of weeks. He recovered. And then at 5 weeks old, we woke up one particular morning, and it was the 1st of October, 2013. And I got my youngest, or my eldest at the time, my eldest son off to nursery, as I did on that morning. And I had a friend coming over to do these like baby hand casting sessions where you put their hands in clay and it Love creates that. This print. And I remember thinking ahead, like, it's Father's Day next year, like maybe this will be a nice Father's Day gift. And as my friend arrived, Thomas was still asleep. He'd had a really disturbed night's sleep. Like he didn't want to wake up and feed. He was grunting in his sleep, kind of pushing into his stomach. And, you know, we just put it down to, you know, a bit of constipation and typical newborn baby, really. And as the day progressed, his condition just deteriorated. And it got to around 11 o'clock in the morning. And I remember walking over to the bay window where he was sleeping in his Moses basket. And as I walked over to the Moses basket to take him out, I undid his baby grove from his hands to put his hands in the clay and from his feet. And literally his hands were like ice. Oh. And I remember turning to my friend and saying, well, like the heating's on, it's not that cold. Sort of wrapping him up, trying to warm him up, quickly put his hand in the clay and put him back in the Moses basket. And when I picked him up, it was like a don't touch me scream. It wasn't like a don't wake me up cry. It was like a put me down, I don't want to be touched scream. And I booked a doctor's appointment. I thought, I'll just get him checked. And I was thinking, maybe I'm just being really oversensitive. You know, he's just come out of hospital a few weeks ago. And maybe it's, you know, paranoid mum. And about half an hour later, he still wasn't right. And I asked my friend to leave. And I rang my husband and I said, look, he doesn't look right. He's crying when I pick him up. Like he's not feeding. And I messaged my friend who's a nurse and she said, well, have you checked his temperature? And because he was so cold, I hadn't really thought to check if he had a high temperature.
Yeah.
Checked his temperature. His temperature was like 39.9, which for any of you listening don't have children, anything over like 38 is like Calpol needs to come out or something needs to happen. And with that, I literally put him in the car seat, got in the car, rang my husband back and said, I'm not taking any chances. I'm going straight down to A&E. And within 20 minutes of arriving in A&E, they put me on a wheelchair. I never forget the moment where he was in my arms. They wheeled us into resuscitation. And I just remember thinking, oh God, like this is quite serious.
Yeah.
All these doctors were swarming around the beds. And this one doctor kept saying this one word and I didn't understand what it meant. And he kept saying sepsis. And I remember thinking, I think I know what sepsis is, but I'm not 100% sure. Obviously later frantically Googling it as you do.
Oh.
And it wasn't until a few days in, actually, they admitted him. They said he had septicemia. He needed to be treated ASAP. And that first night was a real struggle. Like, you know, he if we'd have got him into hospital a few hours later, he wouldn't be here today. It was that close.
Wow.
And the 3 days later, they then diagnosed him with bacterial meningitis, which is one of the worst forms of meningitis. But because he got him in so quickly, he was, you know, he recovered very quickly. You know, kids' health is, you know, they deteriorate very quickly. They get well very quickly.
They do, yeah.
This whole experience for me was when I came out of hospital with Thomas, because I'm a very positive person, I never for one minute thought something terrible is going to happen. Like unconsciously, you know, but consciously you're like, no, it'll be fine. And I remember going back to work a year later and I was really struggling with high anxiety. Every time my kids cried, it would trigger this PTSD response of me being in hospital with him and he's being jabbed in with needles and all sorts of things. And I remember being in the bank in my office a year later, struggling with anxiety, struggling with physically with pelvic issues and all sorts of post having kids body stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting there and thinking about this experience and thinking about how I felt, all this shame that I didn't understand this word sepsis. I didn't know that as a second mom that sepsis is the biggest killer of newborn babies. I didn't know the symptoms. I didn't know that cold hands, cold feet, murmuring and grunting in their sleep. You know, I talk about symptoms a lot for anybody that has children, is I didn't know this and I felt so much shame. And I remember sitting in the bank thinking, how many people feel like this about money? Mm-hmm. Because no one teaches us, or certainly in our age, they didn't teach us about money at school. And so we learn about money from parents, society, religious influences, generational beliefs, all of these things that maybe we'll go into a little later on the show. And I just thought, this is why people don't have healthy relationships with money, healthy habits. Mm. And I just literally, I handed in my notice, I resigned. At this time, I had like a little side hustle business. I thought, that's fine, I can just do this side hustle business. I left the bank. I was so frustrated with the focus being on products, product selling in the bank, that I was like, where is anyone talking about this stuff, the relationship we have with self, the relationship we have with money? I then went on to this huge journey of personal development. I trained into NLP, trauma of money work, financial psychology, like just so many different things. I just couldn't get enough of it. And just started talking about my journey and my experience of being this emotional spender and healing my relationship with money and helping people get out of debt. And then I launched my podcast and it just became part of my life. And now we run, you know, we have three businesses, multi seven-figure businesses. And we're just like, it, for me, my life is so different. And it's not about the money. It's about the impact that we can now have on people who don't have money to go and see a financial advisor, who maybe don't ever want to go and see a financial advisor because of the fear of judgment, the fear of the shame that comes up that I should be good with money, in all the shoulding that we place on ourselves.
Yep.
And so that, for me, that was like the second biggest change in my own life, which is a lesson in itself, because a lot of women think I have to have all the qualifications in order to help people. And you really don't. Your personal life experiences can be enough to catapult somebody else's, to make it look like it's possible for them to create change. And that's why we now have our global mission to empower 1 million women to be financially resilient and not be codependent on their relationship with money.
You're remarkable. Them two experiences are just game-changing experiences and a real reflection, that real reflective moment, aren't they? They're like the proverbial mirror saying, hey, look at this, look at this. And I often say that a lot of the challenges that clients, people, whatever, face in life, ultimately, when you get to the root of it, it's often fear, some kind of fear of something. And let's face it, when we're scared, when we're really scared, I'm not just talking about apprehensive or not sure, I'm talking about fear, real terrifying fear. We will avoid that at all costs. And let's be honest, that makes sense. It kind of makes sense.
And that's the interesting thing about fear. Like it, what you just said there is like, it makes sense. It's almost like a logical part. We're trying to rationalize that fear. But fear, it sits in the body. It's a somatic response. It's a physical response to something that hasn't actually even happened.
Yeah.
Based on something that happened in the past where the perception was, I am in danger. My life is at risk. You know, it's this fight and flight trauma response. And it happens with money. You know, the fear is, oh God, what are people going to say about me? What are people going to say if I put my prices on my website? What are people going to say when I tell them how much I charge? Or what's my family going to say if I suddenly earn a bit of money? And they've always been employed and I'm the first entrepreneur in my family. Yeah. You know, all this fear comes up, which is a perception. It's a perceived fear of something that hasn't actually happened. There's a great analogy for the word fear. If you break down the F-E-A-R, you know, it's a future event appearing real. It's something that hasn't actually happened. But the perception is, oh, shit, like, what are people going to say about me? And it creates this feeling in the body, and it can be often in the stomach, which is the second brain. Mm. It can be in the chest. It can feel like a constriction to our breathing. It can be in the throat often if, you know, there's a fear there of being heard or speaking up. And the fear, whilst it carries on in the body, you can logically think about it. You can try and rationalize it. You can say it's a mindset thing. It's not a mindset challenge. It's a body challenge.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I often say to people, you might know, but your feelings don't. you know, because there's no point sometimes trying to work out why things are happening, because this is just your body's response. Now, when I say that, you know, fear is there and it makes sense, it doesn't mean you can't do something about it. It's just about not then getting hard on yourself about being scared about something that is rational to be scared about. You know, I remember, you know, I grew up in a very disadvantaged background, and I was surrounded by domestic violence and physical abuse at home. And eventually I ended up having to move out around 16. And I remember moving out and not knowing what to do. I didn't even know. I remember the surprise when I found out you had to pay for water. I was like, what? You know, I was just like, what's that about? You know, but I remember the area that I'd managed to get a place in through the council, there were many drug dealers knocking at my door and trying to encourage me to hold things for them. And I remember having an argument with one of them who was driving a Range Rover at the time, and saying, you know, one day I'm going to be successful and I'm going to have all these things that you have, but I'm going to do it a different way. And they were like, yeah, good luck with that. And then I remember making a relative success of myself in the last few years financially, and thinking to myself, I'm going to buy a Range Rover. And I was like, where did that come from? And it wasn't until I looked into it deeply. But a weird thing happened. You're talking about the shame of money. I was walking through town one day and I bumped into a friend, and I was talking, and we were both heading to the car park, and my Range Rover was parked in the car park, and we walked in there. And because I know that, you know, this person doesn't have a Range Rover, that they live a pretty humble life and they work all the hours God sends, but they can't seem to make it work, all these things that happen for people these days, I felt embarrassed. So I got to the car park and I said, stupid me, I've gone to the wrong car park. And I actually walked away and waited for them to go, and then went back and got my car. And I was sat in the car driving back thinking, what was all that about? And then I realized I don't want a Range Rover. That's not who I am. And I sold it. I actually sold it, because I was like, I don't have this car for me. I have this car for something else. And I don't know what that is, but I don't want it anymore. And I sold it. Yeah, I don't even have a car at the moment. I borrow my wife's, which annoys her. But
that's anyway. So powerful. Wow. What a realization of I'm living a life and I possess items, have spent my money on things as a justification of somebody else's beliefs or somebody else's judgment. Congratulations on that realization.
With all that I've learned, just like you, I absolutely resonate on the self-development journey. I'm like a junkie when it comes to these things. I absolutely love it. And I've, you know, there's not many books I haven't read, or seminars I haven't watched, or TED Talks or whatever. And it's funny, you do all that and then you still have those moments where you're like, here's that lesson again, you know?
All the time. Like, well, this is why we do it, don't we? Like, you know, who you are today is not who you are tomorrow.
No.
We learn something overnight about ourselves. But normally the reason we don't is because we're not open to receive those realizations. And what's interesting for me is that when we're closed and we're not open to anything, whether it's realizations about ourselves, others, or even just realization of looking at our numbers or realization of our relationship with money, it's a receiving block. Often it's this wound that's been created based on a perception of fear or scarcity or at risk that we have experienced, where we don't feel free to receive anything. And a good test of this, by the way, is forget the money for a moment. Think about compliments. When someone says to you, I love the pictures on your wall, you'd probably be like accepting of a compliment like that because it's not about you. But if someone said to you, I love your hair right now. Like, I love your outfit. It's so cool. How do you respond to that? Do you say, this old thing, you know, I've worn this for years, or you almost find yourself batting it back because the self doesn't want to accept love. It doesn't want to accept appreciation and gratitude and expression of love. And I find that really interesting because I spent years until quite recently doing that. Like, people would always say to me, your hair looks like you've been in a salon every day. And I'm like, takes me 5 minutes with some GHDs, which is true. But the reason I would bat it back is, again, going play into this wound of not feeling good about myself. And also, I was really badly bullied at school. And the one thing that they used to do is, when I was standing at the bus stop, they would pour orange juice in my hair frequently. And so I created this trauma around my hair specifically, but I didn't know that that's why I was batting these compliments back. But just this awareness of, hold on a second, someone people often are saying nice things about my hair. What would be possible for me if I actually felt good about my hair? Mm. Why do I not feel good about my hair? Ah, there it is.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, yeah.
It's getting back to that root, isn't it?
Yeah, and not necessarily in a trauma way, like a traumatic way. Like, yes, of course, you can have therapy. I believe that everybody should have a therapist on their team. I regularly have therapy.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be a let's stay stuck in the trauma of the past. I'm very much a believer in where's the awareness that we can create around our sense of self to use that awareness in a really positive way for our future. And when I say future, right now in the here and now, our present self and things that we want to do in the future, there's actually really no such thing as time. No. You know, without going into quantum physics and all of that, there is no such thing as time. It's just in the moment we are here right now as you're listening to this podcast episode. And the more we can live in that present moment and experience gratitude and appreciation and awareness of ourselves and others, the happier we can be, the more grounded we are, the support around our own well-being and our relationships and our career. And, you know, it just magnifies. We can piggyback off all of that energy to bring us into things that we want to do.
Yeah, I often say it to people, you know, like that past, as coaches, people very often try to cross that sort of coach therapist-y barrier. And I'm like, I'm not a psychotherapist or a counselor. I'm a coach. I'm forward focused and that stuff's in the past. That said, there are some things that happen to people in the past that are very helpful to help frame the present moment. It informs us. Okay. Because there's often that mistake, isn't there, between what we think we're going to do, what we want to do, but actually what our behavior really is, you know? And it's about that real honest moment with yourself. It's like, yeah, that sounds like a great plan. What will you really do? You know, what will you really do that? Because that's what we should work with. Because otherwise you're stuck on that level, like a computer game, right? Where you keep falling down the hole until you don't. And then you never fall down the hole again. It's because you've gone to the next level, you know? And it's easy to fall in them traps. Easy, very easy. And the word that I really loved that you used then was awareness, because it all comes down to awareness. Awareness is the first point of change. Realizing that this is something I need to focus on. This is something potentially I need to change or influence, or at least just look at, or just admit to myself that this is a thing, you know, like I need to talk about it. And that awareness might last a really long time, you know, but it's all relative, isn't it? It's all important.
And I think this is a practice that every listener can get into, you know, it's just being aware of moments in the day. So could you take half a dozen moments in your day to just be, you know? And like, I do this often if I'm going for a walk on the beach with my dog. Actually, I shouldn't say that too loud because she might hear me. She's asleep, it's all right. Trigger words, quick. But you know, if I'm on the beach, I'll just be present, switch my phone off, switch my podcast off, meditations, whatever you're doing, and just look around you, be present to what you're experiencing in life. And you know, some people really struggle with this. I used to really struggle when people would say things like, I'd be like, oh, that's a bit woo, like it's a bit spiritual, like, but it's just so powerful to take moments, pockets of moments of time in your life, even if you're sitting in the car and you're at the traffic lights, or you're just getting into bed, or, you know, just something or some moment in your life and your day. And you know, if you can do it a few times a day, all the better. And just reflect on, like, what do you feel? What's coming up for you? And it's those moments where you can then really experience real joy and gratitude and love and self-expression. And then maybe there will be times where things come up and you're like, oh God, this just doesn't feel good right now. The car doesn't feel good in my life right now. And it's not so much about what we want more of. It's what do we want less of? You know, law of subtraction rather than law of attraction. What can I get rid of in my life that's sapping my energy, that doesn't bring me joy, that makes me feel bad about myself? You know, and sometimes they can be little things. Sometimes they can be big things. But the point is you've got choice and you've got the awareness that even if you can't do anything about it right now, just surrender to the fact that this has become present and you're aware of it, and then you get to choose whether you do anything about it.
So my wife very often listens to the podcast. So if you're listening to this, please don't get rid of me. Please
pause. Pause.
Yeah, please. That's not what Catherine means. Okay. Stop right now. No, but I mean, I talk a lot about something I call life currents. And it's like that, you know, if you think about the sea, as even if it's rough or it's calm, there's always that undercurrent all the time. And if you get caught in it, it sweeps you away and takes control and causes panic and all those things. And that's like every day, you know, we there's so much of our day that we're not really conscious for. Now, I'm not suggesting that you should be conscious for every second. Maybe that would drive you mad, perhaps, you know. Like, for example, if you tried to consciously drive, that would be quite something to do, wouldn't it? All the things that you have to do when you drive. But it comes down to exactly what you just said, awareness. It's about being aware that there's a moment here and I'm feeling a compulsion. I'm feeling like I have to do this. Wait, let's just press pause. Do I have to, or am I choosing to? Am I reacting or am I responding? You know, these are the things that you can do to sort of counteract that compulsion and that life current that's there. Because very often it's the effort that we put into things. My uncle used to say to me all the time, there's only two things that you can control: your attitude and your effort. And I always remembered that. And I remember getting a job once, and I asked the guy who employed me, like, why did I get the job? Because he was looking through CVs, and he said, because you smiled. And I was like, really? He said, yeah, because you smiled. And I thought, he goes, at the end of the day, when I'm looking at a bunch of CVs and they're all the same, I think to myself, who do I want to hang out with all day? And I'm just like, hey,
love that. So whose CV smiles?
Yeah, well, exactly. It's about like your attitude towards things and you know, your effort. You know, effort is important, isn't it? Nothing really happens without effort. But I've got all these questions, and we've just had this lovely little chit chat. I love it. So much wisdom coming from you. I really, really am grateful. But I mean, commonly, what results in some people having unhelpful habits with money, and whereas some people don't? You know, what sort of decides that in a way?
Well, what decides somebody's habits is based on a couple of things. I mean, habit formation is created by patterns of familiarity, things that we just do on autopilot. And that this is why it's so difficult to change habits, because they're just so familiar to us. And the brain has one main job. It's to keep you safe. It's to protect. So it will always try and keep you in recurring patterns of familiarity. And when you try and do something else, your brain's like, oh, hold on a second. This is unfamiliar. I've never done it before. I'm just going to throw as much stuff as I can at you to keep you back in your comfort zone. Yeah. And that's how habit formation happens. But there's also an element of motivation and willingness. So how willing is the person to change their habit, to quit smoking, to get more sleep, to stop scrolling on their phone, to watch less Netflix and do more meditation, or whatever it is that you want to start practicing. And sometimes there's willingness, and also I would say ability, because there are some situations. I mean, one of the things that I am a huge champion of is financial abuse. I'm actually 2 weeks' time going to spend a week with Richard Branson on Necker Island around the work that the Virgin Unite Trust do around vision projects and impact projects. And there are some situations like financial abuse where you can't do something and you have to get help from externally, help from other people in order to get out of a pattern of familiarity. And, you know, without going into the scenarios around this, but when abuse and things are involved, it can prove challenging. But I think going back to your question about like what makes the difference is that for a lot of people, I think it just comes back to what are the biggest shifts that would feel good for you to make in your life. If you were to drop all the shoulding, all of the cookie cutter approaches, all of the what your friend's doing, what your business partner's doing, your, you know, what your family has always done, if you were to just surrender to life, like what would that look like? If you were just to surrender to not controlling anything, if you take it to one extreme of rather than trying to change things and control things and have regular routines, and what if you were to just drop all of that and just surrender to what will be, and that things happen for you, not to you, and that things are going on for a reason, and you just ride with it, just flow with it. So it's not about controlling and changing habits. It's about stepping into a life that feels easy and it flows. It doesn't feel hard.
Yeah.
And I actually can't remember your question now.
No, answer your question. No, it does. It's about what makes a difference between people having helpful habits and unhelpful habits around money. And I think you're right. I think it is about that, because, you know, I know that, I've had a recent trauma, and it put into perspective that you don't really have any control and you don't really know what's going to happen. And actually, it's that tricking ourselves, that assumptions, those expectations, that's where the pain lies. That is where it is. It's the fact that you thought you knew something and you didn't. And that hurts. And depending on what it is, it'll hurt more and more and more. And it's about understanding that we don't really know anything. We're just going along for the ride. And that's kind of, like you just said, it happens to you, not for you. And it does. It does happen to you. You're absolutely right. You've nailed it. Sometimes that's hard to hear when it just happens. It's about timing, isn't it?
And if it's trauma related, you know, then it's very difficult to justify things happening that are terrible things happening.
Yeah.
But I really believe that you're absolutely right. There are many things in life that you can't control.
Yeah.
But to get curious to why is it we want to control it?
Yeah, good question.
You know, what's the underlying emotion that we want to express or feel that we don't feel able to? So we try and put this control mechanism around it. And that can be a trauma response, often is. But also, there are certain things that happen that we can't control.
Yeah.
So therefore, put your energy into things that you can. So for example, I mean, goodness, if you just experience a high trauma event, you know, if you've lost a loved one, you've lost a job, you know, something that is traumatic. And trauma, by the way, isn't just the big stuff. You know, trauma is any event that exceeds your personal capacity to cope. So it doesn't have to be big. And this is why there's this big stigma around mental health and depression, because people think something, you know, what if something bad happened to you? Like you're on antidepressants. Something terrible must have happened. Well, no, I just don't feel good right now. It doesn't have to be something significant. But also, some of the way that we feel around things that are happening around us, it's to throw your energy into things that you can control. So a really easy example of that is, right now, we are plunging into economic doom, you know, if you watch the news, which I don't.
I don't either.
Again, it's the fear-mongering, isn't it?
Yeah.
But we are going into a recession. You know, petrol prices are going up. Food prices are the highest they've been in 40 years. Energy bills, all of those things. We can't control, to a certain degree, some of those things that are happening. But what can we control? You know, things like changing our cars, changing where we live, significant changes could be possible, but smaller things could be possible. Well, let's have a look at our spending. Let's tweak where we're allocating our pounds and giving every pound a purpose. Could I use my expertise and life experiences to create a little bit of a side business where I could help other people and earn money from it? You know, there's definitely things that we can do, but so often we get engulfed in this fear mindset, this scarcity mindset, because of social media and the news. Think about, you know, are you watching the 10 o'clock news and then going to bed? You know, of course your whole unconscious system is going to be like, all this crazy stuff that's going on in the world. And then you wake up with that. And as soon as you wake up with that energy, it's going to piggyback you for the rest of the day, even if you're not conscious of it, of this negative scarcity, not enoughness energy. So shift that first thing in the morning. You know, one of the things that Mel Robbins, who I love the Diary of a CEO podcast, and Stephen Bartlett was interviewing Mel Robbins, and she was doing this little practice with herself where she'd high five herself in the mirror every morning.
Yeah.
She did it for 2 days and already felt the significant change in herself. You know, so get out of bed, high five yourself in the morning, just bring yourself into a positive energy.
Yeah.
Because you're body and your brain is very powerful. You can piggyback off that energy for quite a long time.
You can. And it's why, you know, I used to be a PT a long time ago, and there was a lot of focus on obviously what you put into your body and what you put out, you know, so how much energy you do. But as I got into that journey and I moved along and I moved towards coaching, I realized that it's not just about the food and liquid that you put in your body. It's about the music you listen to. It's about the films that you watch. It's about the news that you're watching and when you're watching it and all those things. So it's so important. And again, it comes back to that word awareness of what you are listening. Do not be surprised when a sad song makes you feel sad. You know, it's not a surprise, you know, just like when you start cracking up laughing when watching your favorite comedian. It's a thing. And it's about, again, I love what you said there about changing what you can change. So if the fuel prices are high, change the vehicle. You know, you can do that. There might be some ego attached to that, maybe. You know, I found that, I suppose. But there are things you can do. And I suppose it's about focusing on the solution, not the problem. We get so concentrated on, oh no, this is happening. This is awful. This is terrible. Stop. What can we do about it? We can change.
It's such a different energy, isn't it? If you think about that, the solution energy is you're looking for solutions, you're looking for ways to better, you're looking for a way out, you're looking, you know, you're looking for the answer. Mm. It's a can-do, open growth mindset.
Yeah.
Whereas a stuck in the problem, pain of a situation, and by the way, that isn't a bad thing in itself. I think as a society as well, we often think that that's a bad thing. We don't want to feel unhappy. We don't want to feel depressed. We don't want to feel angry. Let's just move on quickly. Actually, if your body's expressing that, you have to express that.
Absolutely.
And listening to a sad song, I often do, you know, if my body's feeling like, oh God, I feel pain. Like I'm a big empath, high empath. So if there's stuff going on in the world, like when the war started, or, you know, when all the abortion stuff going on in the US, I literally felt like I could cry and cry and cry and cry. And so I did cry and cry and cry. And I think that it's not, we have to talk about how it's okay to be sad and feel depressed, you know, feel stressed and worry. And we have to express those things. But if we stay in it for too long, then that creates this lack, this scarcity, this not enoughness, this I'm not good enough sense of being, and that's not a positive place to be if it continues for a longer period.
It's that rumination, isn't it? Rumination is like poking the cup all the time. It's just like, come on now, there's a time when you've just got to leave it alone. And I think one of the couple of things that you've said has brought me to the thinking of people need to understand what the emotion is they're experiencing. You know, very often people say they're angry and they treat it as an emotion. But very often, I think the anger is a response to an emotion. You know, it's that, oh, I'm angry because I'm feeling resented, or I'm feeling not good enough, or I'm feeling this, or whatever it is. But identifying that emotion, you've said that a few times, I think that's absolutely right. It's about, okay, again, all of this stuff you're saying comes back to that reflection of self. Like, what am I doing? What am I bringing to this table? How is my attitude affecting this situation? And it's about understanding that emotion. What is the emotion of it? I've got this wonderful thing that my therapist gave me, and it's a color chart. And it's every color, I don't know if you can see that, has got an emotion.
Ooh,
and very
I
often
that.
I look at it and I try to work out what I'm feeling about something. Because historically, I've never been good at that because I was never allowed. But I'm realizing we've not spent a great deal about money yet.
It's like, not about the money.
No, well, that's it though, isn't it? It's like when somebody's trying to lose weight, it's very often a symptom of something else, you know?
Well, let's bring this back to the conversation around money. You know, that what you've just shared there, and the color theory, color psychology is fascinating. I learned a lot around this when I was training as an image consultant. You know, anger is often the color of red, and it can be expressed, you know, often through the voice and in the chest, that this kind of metaphysics work. And we use two really powerful modalities in our communities. One, which is emotional freedom technique, or EFT, otherwise known as tapping.
Love
where
it.
You're actually using different meridian points to tap away trauma from the body. And then we use something called matrix reimprinting, which is a less known modality, or less well known, which is going into experiences and memories of the past and changing the perception, and then re-imprinting them into current self. And the combination of that can really identify emotions that have colors attached and shapes attached and certain areas of the body. But in terms of what you were saying about the emotional response, let's take overspending, for example. So me in my 20s, I would walk down the high street pretty much every day because I worked in town. I would buy, you know, go through past the shops, and I'd always go in, and the feeling for me was, oh, I feel crap about myself. If I buy that dress, actually, that's quite flattering. I feel better about myself. Oh, so I'll just get that dress and it will hang in the wardrobe. And I put the dress on. The next day, I still feel crap about myself. Right. What about that pair of shoes? Right. That will fix me. I'm going to get that pair of shoes, you know, or that handbag or whatever it is. And people create addictions. You know, it could be alcohol, drugs, shopping, food, overeating, for example, is another common one. But what is the emotion that you're experiencing in that moment?
Yes.
So for me, it was shame. It could be boredom. It could be stress. It could actually be joy. I could be celebrating. I've had the most amazing day at work today. I'm going to go celebrate and buy a bottle of champagne. I'm going to grab a bar of chocolate from the fridge. You know,
well, some joy can come with guilt, can't it? You know,
100%. Yeah. Yeah. But the key there is to release the pattern, the cycle, the habit, if you like, might be to, well, what is the emotion? How else could I create the same feeling of the opposite of how I want to feel? So maybe I want to feel relaxed, or I want to feel good about myself. Can I do that in a way that doesn't involve money?
Yeah.
So could I have a hot bubble bath instead? Could I just look at what's already in my wardrobe and get rid of all the stuff that isn't feeling good for me, give it to a nice charity and feel good about myself and work on that piece? Mm. You know, what's the alternative action that you could do that doesn't involve the physical exchange of money to try and fulfill a need that ultimately is something that we're just self-sabotaging around?
Yeah. I mean, look at that, the power of all that you do just to avoid looking at that very painful emotion or that uncomfortable emotion. You're absolutely right. I mean, that's exactly the thing. It's about looking at that emotion and what it means to you and how it's impacting you. I spoke to someone called Nikki Hill on here once, and she said she's more focused on the impact of something rather than the blame, because blame has no resolution. Impact, you can do something about. And I thought that was really cool. So I know you're going to have to go soon. You're very busy. So I just wanted to make sure that people got some idea of what they can do to change their habits around money. So what sort of things can people do to change their habits around money? Like, I don't know, top three or something like that.
Yeah, great question. I would say step number one is to bring awareness to your relationship with money. We have a great quiz on our website, on katherinemorgan.com, that can help you with this. But it's say, what is my relationship with money? You know, am I an oversaver? Am I an overspender? Am I an overgiver? Do I give to everybody else's needs and not my own? Am I a risk taker? Do I take too many risks? You know, what is the relationship with money that you have? And the second part to this then is, how is it supporting you? So how is it benefiting you in some way? And there will always be ways, even if you're an overspender, because if you're an overspender, you're going to be very impulsive. So I'm still impulsive. I'm not an overspender anymore, but I'm super impulsive. I can say yes to opportunities. If my friend rings me half an hour before there's a concert, do you want to go? Yeah, sure. Like if I could just walk up into an airport and just fly anywhere in the world, that would really excite me. Like,
yeah.
I don't want to change that because that's part of who I am. So how is it supporting you to have that relationship with money, which really is the relationship with yourself? The next step then is sabotaging. How is this relationship that I have with money sabotaging me? So how is it not supporting you, basically? Sabotaging or supporting you or not supporting? So for example, maybe the fact that you're impulsive with your relationship with money means that you're overspending. And maybe there's one specific trigger or one specific area that you're overspending in. And that leads on to the next step, which is, what is one small step that I could take that would place me in a better situation than I'm in today? And the reason that that's so important is because most people think it takes big change to create any change. And it's really the small incremental steps of change that create lifelong change. And focus on the small steps. So on the podcast, we say small steps, big wins. Mm-hmm. What's the next incremental change or thing that I could work on that would create positive impact, using that word impact, or that would put me in a situation that's better than where I am today? And that can be a feeling. Mm-hmm. How can I feel better tomorrow than I am today? Maybe I'm going to open my bank statement or have a conversation with somebody or reach out for some support. Or stop the shoulding on myself, or stop following all these people on social media that are making me feel bad about myself.
Yeah.
Or get rid of all the clothes in my wardrobe that are not fitting me, or change my job. You know, whatever comes up for you, just ask yourself that question, get curious to yourself. And then that leads to the action. And then that action is going to be very motivating. It's going to feel important for you because you've come up with it.
Mm. And
then the final part to that is, you know, who do I need to support me in this decision? Who do I need to support me in creating this small step of change? Is it a partner or is it not? Is it a financial advisor or a financial coach or a therapist or a buddy or someone in a Facebook community or a podcast host? Or, you know, who is it that can support you in creating that small change?
So as a response to what can you do, I've got bringing awareness to it, understanding the benefits and support surrounding it, where is it sabotaging you, and then the small actions you can take to sort of get through it and get past it. But I mean, my opinion only, but I believe that whenever you're speaking to a really amazing coach, they will always use the word awareness. They will always use the word curiosity. They will always use the word accountability. And they will always ask you what you need. And you do all of those things. You're amazing. You really are. You're somebody doing the right work.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And also to yourself, yeah, and to anyone listening to this, it's don't feel like you are alone in this. You know, no one taught us about money. And money is not the taboo subject. People are like, oh, money's a taboo subject. We'd rather talk about sex and talk about money. It's not money that's the taboo. It's the meaning that you give to money that creates the taboo. So having these conversations can feel hard, and they will feel hard. But the more we have them, the more we normalize these conversations, and the more we can come together collectively to go, do you know what? I was shit with money in my 20s. I was a financial advisor. I'm not good with money, or I wasn't good with money. And that's okay. That's okay to admit those things. It's almost like an AA meeting, isn't it? I stand up. I am bad with money. But it's that the narrative that we use with ourselves is one of the most important things as part of that awareness piece. What are you saying to yourself about money? Yeah. I am bad with money. I'm terrible at math. So I can't possibly get good with money because I'm not good with numbers.
No, you're right. And again, it's about that meaning that you're applying to those words. Because if I say all the same words in a different language, they don't have the same impact. So it's not about the words. It's about the meaning that you're applying to it. So that's important to understand, because it speaks to what you said when you started. It's all about you. It's all about yourself and how you are managing everything that's going on around you. Anyway, I know we're almost out of time or out of time, I'm not sure which, but I just wanted to ask one last thing. And that is there anything that you'd like to pass along that could help anyone with their self-development?
I would love to gift anyone who's listening to this a copy of my book. I launched it on my 40th birthday last year. It was like, how do I celebrate turning 40? Oh no, I'll publish my book. And we give this away for free. We just ask you to cover postage. I would love to leave that with any of your listeners and watchers today. If you just head to itsnotaboutthemoney.com, you can grab a free copy of the book, It's Not About the Money, and just use that. You know, it's a book that is split into practical steps and emotional freedom. So there'll be a whole bunch of journaling questions in there. There's a whole bunch of questions that you'll be like, oh my God, I'm not answering that, because there'll be some fear that comes up, you know? But that's a good awareness for why is it that I feel resistant to answering that question, perhaps. But there'll be a whole bunch of exercises in there that can just create those little nuggets of light bulb moments. And feel free to let me know, drop me a DM on Instagram and Catherine Morgan Money, and just share your little insights with us. And that I think would be a good step for anybody listening.
That is incredibly kind. It really is incredibly kind, and just speaks to, again, what you're really doing, you know, what you're trying to do. There are some people that talk about it, and there's some people that are about it, and you're about it. But thank you so much for today. I'd love to have talked a bit more about money and trauma, but maybe we'll do this again someday, you know.
I'd love to.
That'd be great. But I mean, just let people know where they can find you on social and websites and everything, and anything that you want to draw their attention to.
Yeah, sure. I mean, catherinemorgan.com is our website. You can access the quiz on there. And if you want to follow me on social media, I mean, I'm everywhere, but I tend to hang out on Instagram, Catherine Morgan Money, Catherine with a C. Or of course, you can come and listen to us over on the In Her Financial Shoes podcast.
That's brilliant. Thank you, Catherine. So that's just, yeah, great start to my day, if I'm honest.
Amazing. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. Cheers. So that's all from me for this episode. Thanks again to my podcast producer, Charlie, from Chatter Podcast, and I'll catch you next time for another episode of the Self-Development Podcast.